COVID-19 has been wreaking havoc for months, but creating a vaccine for the illness takes time.
The vaccine development in total is so long that if we don't get a head start immediately, then the delay to have a vaccine ready would be even longer.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the airlines say they're in trouble, and not to put it lightly, this is what free fall looks like. And Americans are warming to the idea of free college. For several countries, though, this is nothing new.
It's one of the most important things about the German education system, that you've mostly got no fees.
And imagine there's a group of people who have not heard a thing about coronavirus.
The rules of this game require virtually no contact with the outside world. No TVs, no phones, no computers, no news.
Not anymore. Those stories today here on The World. COVID-19 is a human disease, and it's also going to be tough on the global economy. Right now, it's not a pretty picture. Businesses are closed, people are staying home, and of course, travel is all but coming to a full halt. The major U.S. airlines say they're in big financial trouble, and they're already asking Washington for $50 billion in assistance. When asked about the state of the airline industry, President Trump had suggested that the government is willing to step in.
We're going to back the airlines 100%. It's not their fault. It's nobody's fault, unless you go to the original source. But it's nobody's fault. And we're going to be in a position to help the airlines very much. We've told the airlines we're going to help them.
They want $25 billion.
Well, we're going to be helping. We're going to be backstopping the airlines. We're going to be helping them very much.
But this story is not just about the U.S. airlines. It's a global industry. Phil Seymour is an aviation specialist with the consulting firm IBA, based in the UK.
As somebody who's seen a few ups and downs across the cycles over the years, aviation has tended to be fairly resilient when you look at it in the long term. But looking back at 9/11, SARS 2003, and even First Gulf War, there were obviously airline failures in those times, but they only appear as blips in terms of growth of air traffic. However, this does have a different feel because it's, you know, nowhere in the world is really unaffected by this downturn.
Yeah, so you would say this is more than like a 9/11 blip.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Interestingly, it looks like the freight market is picking up a little bit. You know, China appears to have opened up somewhat. And because of the lack of passenger aircraft with belly space, some of the airlines with the cargo, such as Cargolux, Cargologix, and Atlas Air, appear to be seeing an uptick in freighter operations.
So let's look at the passenger airlines. If you look at the list of 24 that are seriously drawing down, do they have something in common? Like, what kind of airlines globally are the most vulnerable right now?
This is the issue, I suppose, is there doesn't appear to be any hiding place. If you've got regional aircraft, or, you know, let's say over this side of the water, the Air France's, Lufthansa and British Airways, they have short-haul aircraft, short, medium-haul aircraft, but, you know, Europe is closing down, so there's nowhere else to place those in operations. And then just over a week ago, I think there was some thoughts that capacity could be moved from the Far East long-haul travel into the US. But of course, you know, that avenue has now been closed. So really, this affects the operators with the long-haul aircraft. It affects those short-haul aircraft. And there doesn't appear to be any hiding place right now.
Where are carriers parking their mothballed aircraft for the time being?
It will become an issue here. It was already an issue in the States, of course, because Boeing have taken up a lot of parking spaces due to the MAX issues. So there's 440, I think, parked up MAXes. You've obviously got a great advantage of some, you know, open spaces over there. But the issue is going to be much more of a problem over here in Europe, where there's probably a lack of less regional airports per square mile than there is in the USA. So, but it is important to protect asset value at these times. You don't just park an aircraft and leave it for 3 months.
So as you said, there's no place to hide for these companies. If we look at winners and losers, which airlines are likely to survive and perhaps buy up some more struggling airlines, or is everyone at risk, big and small?
Well, you know, in any sector right now, cash is king. The airlines with the cash reserves and government support will be the winners. There's quite a difference around the world. You know, in some countries, there's, well, I suppose, equivalent of Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. In some parts of the world, there isn't that luxury. Indeed, over here in the UK, there was no support over the last few years for airlines like Monarch, Thomas Cook, or Flybe. They were just allowed to fail.
U.S. airlines are asking for a very expensive $50 billion government bailout. It's not clear they'll get it. Do other airlines around the globe have that option?
Yeah, some will. The EU has generally been not very supportive. In fact, they will fine countries or airlines if they receive state aid. But I expect that will have to be relaxed.
How essential is the global airline industry to the global economy?
It is significant. Obviously, you can't have a global hotel and resort industry unless you have a global network to connect to all those operations. So I think the industry is facing a massive issue and will have to rely on, you know, government and financial institution support.
Phil Seymour, an aviation analyst with IBA Consulting in the UK. Thank you for your thoughts.
Thank you.
It's impossible to say exactly how this coronavirus pandemic will end. What's crucial, though, is finding a vaccine. The good news is that researchers around the world in the public and private sectors are joining forces in this effort. But these things take time, as Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris.
By most estimates, it will be more than a year before we have a vaccine for the new coronavirus, which causes the disease known as COVID-19. It could take around 9 months to develop the vaccine in a lab and then another 9 months to test it out, first in animals, then in humans. That sounds like a while, but according to scientists,
we already see that it's been developed very quickly.
That's Christiana Gurka, the head of vaccine research at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, one of France's leading scientific research centers. In January, the institute appointed Gurka to join its coronavirus task force. They were able to move quickly once researchers in China released the genetic sequence of the virus, the first crucial step in coming up with a vaccine.
And from there, even though the epidemic was still very small, we discussed internally that it would probably be good to start making a vaccine, because the vaccine development in total is so long that if we don't get a head start immediately, then the delay to have a vaccine ready would be even longer.
Gurka's vaccine team is working on what's called a measles vector approach. The main benefit of this is that it's safe and reliable. This method has also been used in clinical trials for vaccines for SARS and Zika.
We already have experience with the technology in humans, so that it was safe, well-tolerated, and immunogenic after just one immunization.
In other words, she means that the vaccine works after just one injection. Gurka's group is one of more than 100 labs across the globe that are racing to develop a vaccine. Many of them are collaborating across national borders and the public and private sectors to speed the process.
This idea of working across borders and across governments is very important.
Bernie Graham is the deputy director of the Vaccine Research Center at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, NIAID, a part of the U.S. National Health Institute. NIAID has been getting a lot of attention for its partnership with a biotech startup called Moderna. They're working on a vaccine that's moving super fast. Phase 1 trial started earlier this week with a group of 45 healthy people in Seattle who were given test shots. Moderna is using something called mRNA medicine, which delivers instructions to cells in the body to make certain proteins that can fight disease.
But now the question is, and what do we have to do to make the more advanced development go rapidly so that we can actually have a vaccine for use within a reasonable amount of time?
For him, reasonable would mean less than 2 years. Back at the Pasteur Institute, I'm in the Vinuzzi lab, run by the virologist Marco Vinuzzi. This scientist is throwing chemicals together in what looks like a high-tech blender.
Can you tell me what you're doing?
Yes, I'm perfect.
What she's doing is part of the lab's work, tracking the way viruses evolve over time with the hope of advancing vaccine development. But they don't expect any immediate breakthroughs.
We imagine the vast majority of approaches that we try to develop to make vaccines will not work.
Vinuzzi's lab has started preliminary research on a vaccine that would target a number of coronaviruses, not just the one that causes COVID-19. This would be groundbreaking, especially as researchers speculate that current vaccine breakthroughs could become obsolete as the virus evolves.
We can imagine that in 10 years, an entirely different coronavirus will come out for which the current vaccine would not work.
Vannuzzi says for now, the Moderna NIAID vaccine holds the most promise. And he agrees that working together is helping to speed the long process of vaccine development.
In virology, we're such a small community overall that we all know each other around the world. This time with COVID-19, I think, has really been nice to see that there is a much bigger, true collaboration where whether it's in public health or in the research community, the results are made available as soon as possible. The tools, molecular tools that groups are developing are being made readily available to other teams.
This is something to take comfort in, he says. The path toward a vaccine against the new coronavirus isn't an arms race, but a true global partnership. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
If you've been paying any attention to the news, you probably know quite a bit about COVID-19 now. Imagine, though, being entirely unaware of it. Imagine that you've never even heard the word coronavirus. That's a situation for one group of people, as The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
People around the world are living in a new reality of being stuck inside their homes. But most of them have access to the news and are constantly hearing updates about the COVID-19 pandemic. Contestants on the game show Big Brother aren't getting those updates.
The rules of this game require virtually no contact with the outside world. No TVs, no phones, no computers, no news.
Big Brother is an international reality show in which a group of people live together in the same house while cameras record their every move. Big Brother Germany started filming in early February, and contestants on Big Brother Canada moved in a few weeks ago. So they weren't told that entire cities and countries are on lockdown. They weren't told that their families are panic buying toilet paper and canned beans. In a recent episode, the Canadian contestants said they were confused why the live audience wasn't in the studio the last time someone got voted off the show.
It was all empty because the first eviction, we heard people,
In the series filmed in Israel, the hosts explained that their contestants would stay in the dark, too. The hosts told viewers on Sunday that they'll play canned applause so the contestants think a live audience is in the studio. Big Brother Italy also has a house full of people right now, but producers there decided to tell contestants about COVID-19, prompting them to sing the popular song Azzurro, which has become a sort of Italian anthem during the pandemic. The German cast's blissful ignorance has also run its course. After backlash on social media, producers agreed to tell the contestants about the pandemic. The show announced a live broadcast of the Tuesday evening episode in Germany.
Am 10. Februar ins Big Brother Haus einziehen, ist nur Asien vom Coronavirus betroffen.
This is not the first time that Big Brother has faced the situation. In 2001, Big Brother contestants were likely the only Americans to not hear about the September 11th terrorist attacks. One of the contestants, Monica Bailey, had a cousin who worked in the Twin Towers. Producers ended up breaking the show's news blackout rule to talk to Monica.
She did go to work this morning, okay? It doesn't mean anything bad, okay, at this point. I just want you to know this.
Okay.
Monica's cousin was one of the victims of the 9/11 attacks. Today, contestants in Big Brother houses around the world could also have relatives who are suffering. And while contestants in Germany and Australia are being told about COVID-19, production will continue as normal. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Coming right up in non-coronavirus news, free college. It's a thing in the Democratic primary race, but it's not really new. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Free college. If you're a parent like me, how good does that sound? The idea has become an extremely popular one among Democratic voters. Bernie Sanders has been saying he wants to make all public universities free for everyone. Recently, Joe Biden said he also wants free tuition at public universities for students from families that make up to $125,000 a year. This may be a new idea here in the U.S., but not for the rest of the globe. The World's Marnette Fedaris takes a look at how free college has played out in other countries.
Amanda Steinmaus is a student in Germany majoring in English and history. She wants to be a teacher.
I study at the University of Duisburg-Essen.
that's a public university. There are no general tuition fees, so you might say that's quite affordable.
Being able to pay for college is a big concern for a lot of students. This year in the U.S., there's been a lot of talk around free college. Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders is especially focused on free tuition at all public universities, just like what Germany offers. But Steinmaus also points to the other possible costs when it comes to college, especially housing and food.
And that's okay for me. I'm fine with that, but we find that a lot of students have difficulty even paying that much.
Steinmaus is active in the student union, so she hears a lot about students' struggles. In the early 2000s, German universities tried charging students tuition. There was a big backlash. The student union fought back.
Education is a human right, so it should be free for everybody. And yeah, there's no detrimental effect to having no tuition fees. Really, it's, you know, one of the most important things about the German education system, that you've mostly got no fees.
Scandinavian countries have the same philosophy. Citizens pay a high tax rate for both healthcare and education. Bjørn Stenseke is a professor of higher education at the University of Oslo in Norway.
There is a relatively high agreement that these are areas where you need some form of public coordination.
Students in Norway can get loans that can be converted into a stipend if they complete their studies.
They end up with less debt.
To see how free tuition has been implemented in more recent years, there's Chile. Like the U.S., markets dictated how universities could charge. Students had to take out loans to pay for tuition. Then there were mass protests to make college free. Voters elected a new president, Michelle Bachelet, who promised free tuition for everyone. But then economic growth in Chile slowed down. The free college program was scaled down. While free tuition opens the door to college for some low-income students, they still have to do well on college entrance exams to get into the best universities. Recently, high school students took to the streets, again, in Chile, because they say the tests are unfair. Marcos Farre is a high school student in Santiago, Chile, with a student group organizing the protest.
Solo los colegios de los barrios más acomodados tienen efectivamente una preparación buena para entrar a la universidad.
He says schools in affluent neighborhoods have resources to better prepare their students for the university entrance exams.
La gente que vive en los...
Meanwhile, he says schools in vulnerable communities don't have the money to prep their students. In Brazil and Russia, tuition-free colleges decide who gets in using entrance exams. They face similar criticisms that this system still favors wealthier students who are better equipped to do well on these tests. Faure, the student from Chile, says many students in his country feel that free tuition isn't enough.
Nosotros como estudiantes secundarios además creemos que, bueno, justamente la gratuidad no es suficiente.
While many believe free tuition is a good idea, Faure thinks it's a first step of many when it comes to providing more equal access to higher education. For The World, I'm Marnette Fideres.
All over the world, we're seeing a wave of closures, schools, businesses, factories, and calls for social distancing over the coronavirus. But there are some especially worrying exceptions. Immigration detention centers here in the U.S., for one, they're still operating and were already crowded. Immigrant advocates are calling on authorities to release at least the most vulnerable detainees for health safety reasons. The World's Monica Campbell explains.
So there are nearly 40,000 immigrants at detention centers across the United States. They could easily be confused with a prison. Movement is restricted. There are cells or maybe large dorm-style rooms with people in bunk beds. And you also have families in detention. One key difference that I'd like to point out is that people are in detention not because of criminal convictions. They are in detention centers because they're going through immigration proceedings, so civil detention.
Right. What are the concerns about conditions in these facilities when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, the real fears are that the virus could spread quickly in these densely populated facilities. There are some cases of staff members and detained immigrants being tested. Results are not in. There's particular concern at a large detention center in Tacoma, Washington, near Seattle. And about 900 immigrants are currently detained there now. And I spoke with Matt Adams. He's the legal director at the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. His team is fighting to get at least 9 medically vulnerable detainees out.
they are frankly terrified. They know that they're penned up, that there's nothing they can do, that they can't take the measures that everyone else in the country, and in fact, everyone else in the world, is being told that they need to take, and that is to isolate themselves, to distance themselves from other people.
And one of the plaintiffs is Kelvin Melgar Alas. He is a 40-year-old citizen of El Salvador, and he's been hospitalized multiple times for pneumonia while detained. So his health is fragile.
He's in a group setting, a pod. They're all sleeping, you know, in bunk beds in the same pod area. The detention facilities are simply not equipped to keep dozens of people in isolation.
Do detention centers here in the States have medical clinics?
They do, but there are a number of pretty damning reports, including by government watchdogs as well, that medical treatment in these centers can be poor. There are a number of people who've died in detention or become seriously ill.
What about the continuing detention of migrants? I mean, one person with COVID-19 left unscreened and enters into the detention facility. You can imagine how quickly that would spread.
Well, they're not left unscreened, according to ICE. Anybody new coming into the detention center being held in federal custody, they are being screened.
Gotcha. So Matt Adams, as we heard, is making the case to let some detainees out. What is the federal government's reasoning for not wanting to do that?
Well, immigration officials said in a statement that they take strict measures to keep the virus from spreading. They've also stopped social visits. But they haven't provided specifics about quarantine areas that have been set up within detention centers beyond solitary confinement cells or plans if an outbreak occurs.
And is that correct? Are there solitary confinement units being used for quarantine?
We don't know if solitary units are being used for quarantine.
If these people were let out, where would they go?
They have family in the United States. So advocates say let them out, be in safer settings, and they can be released, for example, with an ankle monitor to track their movements. So a number of people in detention centers nationwide have a home to go to.
Like so many things, though, these days, an unsettled and unsettling situation. The World's Monica Campbell, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
News headlines are coming right up. You're listening to The World. When the coronavirus hit Denmark, authorities moved quickly. They closed pretty much everything and told people to just stay home.
But actually, I think it was very wise to have a total shutdown at once.
Not only to keep people healthy, Denmark is trying to protect its entire healthcare system. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Canada will join lots of other nations and close its border to most foreign nationals. The goal, of course, is to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau made the announcement this week, so now Canadians are scrambling to get home from places all over the world. One country that's exempt so far from the new travel restrictions is Canada's closest neighbor, the United States. Today, Trudeau was asked why, and he said nothing has been ruled out just yet.
Comme j'ai dit, on est en train de coordonner avec les États-Unis, avec les autorités américaines.
Trudeau said he does not want to hurt Canadians by stopping essential goods from crossing the U.S.-Canadian border during this pandemic. Dr. Isaac Bogosh is a physician at Toronto General Hospital. Doctor, what do you think of Prime Minister Trudeau's decision to temporarily allow Americans to Canada? Should he have been more deliberate from the beginning?
Wow, I mean, we've been debating this all day. And, you know, I've definitely heard both sides of the story. Some people say, you know what, shut it down. We cannot import more cases of COVID-19 into Canada. If we really want to limit our epidemic, this should apply to everyone. And others, you know, others say, you can't shut out the Americans. This is one of the largest land borders. This is essential for trade and tourism. This is, you know, basically the lifeblood of Canada and part of what drives our economy. And, you know, if we shut the border to everyone except the Americans, maybe we can mitigate a little bit the cases that are coming in through other measures, like with our social distancing measures.
I mean, it gets really to the core of border closure during a pandemic. What do you think about countries closing their borders in general to fight the coronavirus outbreak? Is it effective?
The WHO is pretty clear. There's the international health regulations that clearly state that borders should not be closed because they can actually do more harm than good. They can take a tremendous economic toll, and also they can prevent affected countries from fighting the infection. Now, I mean, I see some truth to that. I really do. I mean, especially since, you know, a place like Canada does not have all the resources it needs in-house. But on the other hand, I can certainly see why countries have been doing this, because by decreasing the influx of cases, it might enable a country to really get a handle on the cases that they have internally.
So Toronto, where you are, was hit hard during the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s. What lessons has Canada learned from that?
Oh, plenty. I mean, certainly the way that public health has changed. I got to say, I'm not here to pat ourselves on the back, but now, if we look at up till now, I think Canada's managed this pretty well. We've ruled in a bunch of cases. We've ruled out a bunch of cases. The cases have been managed appropriately. But really, now is the real test. We'll see how well our system can cope and if we truly can manage a much larger influx of cases.
What is your confidence level? How confident are you that Canada and the rest of the world can defeat this virus?
I'm really unclear right now in Canada. We really need all Canadian citizens to, you know, practice these social distancing measures. And I think if everyone fills their end of the bargain, we'll get through this better than most other places.
So after SARS cleared in the early 2000s, this happened in Toronto. I'm just curious, though. I mean, yeah, time to celebrate. But were people too quick to return to normal?
No, I remember that vividly. That was called SARS stock. And, you know, Toronto got hit very hard from SARS. Businesses suffered. It was a tough time to be in the city. And, you know, that was a really, really cathartic concert. I mean, it was packed. Like, it was packed. And it basically told the world, you know, Toronto is open for business. Come to our restaurants. Come to our hotels. And also for the people in Toronto that were living through SARS, you know, those were different times. People were wearing masks. People weren't riding on the subway. People were avoiding large crowds, sort of similar to now. It was, but that really mainly affected Toronto and not much of the rest of Canada. And now, of course, the rest of Canada is experiencing this as well. But I remember when it was all over, it was such a wonderful celebration.
Well, here's hoping at the end of all this, we can have a Corona stuck concert. fingers crossed. Dr. Isaac Bogosh with Toronto General Hospital, thank you very much for being with us.
Anytime.
That's the Rolling Stones headlining what was called SARS stock in Toronto back in the summer of 2003. The coronavirus spread quickly in Denmark. Danish authorities have also acted quickly. Their primary objective, like many countries, prevent Denmark's healthcare system from being overwhelmed. Denmark has a population of about 5.5 million. About 1,000 people in Denmark have tested positive for the virus. But so far, there have been relatively few deaths and not many sick people landing in hospital beds. From Copenhagen, Tom Carstensen reports.
All buses in Copenhagen now have signs saying they will only let on a very limited number of passengers. This is not an issue on this bus I'm on to Hvidovre Hospital, about 3 miles to the west of central Copenhagen. It's just me and the driver. The streets we drive on are close to empty. It's like something out of an apocalyptic movie.
Velkommen til endnu et pressemøde her i Statsministeriet.
The coronavirus is keeping most people at home, and that's where they should be, according to the Danish Prime Minister.
Der vil komme svære situationer nu for rigtig mange borgere, og der bliver...
Mette Frederiksen has been holding regular news conferences. She's even talking about temporary legislation to limit freedom of movement. This sort of thing has not been put in place here since the Nazi occupation.
Alle skoler og dagtilbud lukkes...
Over three very hectic days, the Danish government ordered all schools closed, public servants sent home, public gatherings of more than 100 people were banned, restaurants and bars are shut down too.
Fra i morgen, der lukker de danske grænser.
Now the borders are closed for everybody except citizens of Denmark and permanent residents. All of these measures are about one thing: to save the healthcare system. I'm at this hospital to meet Dr. Thomas Benfield. He's one of the top epidemiologists leading the country's fight against COVID-19.
Hi, Dag. Nå, jeg var ikke sikker på grund af, at jeg tænker.
Signs on the hospital doors say, "Do not enter if you have a cough or a fever," and there's hardly anyone here. Benfield leads me through a back entrance to his office. I asked him if the Danish government is doing the right thing by shutting down pretty much everything.
Today, I'm pretty sure it was the right move because we have seen more local transmission than we had just a few days ago. It took me by surprise, definitely. I had anticipated a more gradual increase in restrictions, but actually I think it was very wise to have a total shutdown at once.
Benfield says it's a no-brainer, really.
And I think the experience from China and from Italy, I think you can't do enough to contain this epidemic.
The goal, he says, is to avoid the kind of total meltdown that's taken place in Italy.
We're definitely hoping that we're not going to experience the catastrophic crash they experienced in Italy through all the different measures that we're taking.
But one thing that's not happening a lot here in Denmark is testing people for COVID-19. Benfield says the country certainly has a lot more infections than the official numbers say.
But fortunately, very few of them are seriously ill.
The official stance in Denmark is that everyone is now considered to be at risk of having the virus already. That's why people are being told to stay at home.
For torsdag fik vi en meddelelse om at Thomas Kahlenberg, den tidligere Brøndby og landsholdsspiller, er smittet med.
One of the first celebrities to be diagnosed with COVID-19 is Thomas Kahlenberg, a former professional soccer player. Kasper Juhl works for Kahlenberg's former soccer club. At a recent match, Juhl and many others shook hands with Kahlenberg.
A couple of days later, we got the news that he was tested positive for the coronavirus.
Juhl talks with me over the phone because he's not allowed to meet people in person. Already more than 70 people in the soccer world are in quarantine, and the Danish league is suspended.
I was lucky to be able to be quarantined at home. We kind of sealed off the middle of the house, and then we have some glass doors to seal off the rest of the house.
Were you tested?
No, I wasn't tested because I didn't have any symptoms. And I still haven't had.
Juhl says he's getting daily phone calls from health authorities, and he's happy with the way everything's been handled.
It's not about me. It's about if I had gotten the virus and I could infect other people not knowing, and that could spread.
Jeg kan oplyse, at den smittede er en mand, der sammen med sin familie blev testet i går på Sjællands.
Jakob Tage Ramløn was the first person in Denmark to contract the virus. The TV journalist came home from a ski trip in Italy and went back to work. Then he got sick, and his doctor told him to get tested.
In the late night, I found out I was the first person in Denmark that had the COVID virus. That was kind of a shock.
Ramløn says he, along with many colleagues, had to go into quarantine. He says the authorities have been engaged and effective, but things have also been a bit chaotic.
Early on also, they were not all that coordinated, all of them. They made us a bit uneasy sometimes, but it was also it was never in any way that made our health situation bad.
Denmark is looking at a long period of shutdown ahead, says Thomas Benfield, the epidemiologist. But he's hopeful that hospitals will not be overwhelmed with too many patients at once.
It's a quiet period. We're waiting for what might happen. But clearly there's going to be some major disruption in our healthcare system as well.
Benfield tells me that he's still optimistic for now. As for other countries, he says they need to be taking more drastic action. For the world, I'm Tom Carstensen in Copenhagen.
Among the countless changes because of the coronavirus, the state of Ohio at the last minute postponed its presidential primary set for today. Other states, Arizona, Illinois, and Florida, went ahead with theirs. With these primaries in mind, former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders squared off in a live debate over the weekend. Sanders responded to comments that he made a few weeks ago, praising Fidel Castro's record on literacy and education.
I think we condemn authoritarianism, whether it's in China, Russia, Cuba, any place else. But to simply say that nothing ever done by any of those administrations had a positive impact on their people would, I think, be incorrect.
Sanders' comments might not be sitting well with Latino voters in Florida who have ties to countries like Cuba and Venezuela. Joining me today is Alejandra Martinez, producer at WLRN in Miami. She's also reporting for our Every 30 Seconds project. Hello, Alejandra.
Hi, Marco.
So what exactly in Senator Sanders' comments a few weeks ago sparked this outrage among some Latinos in Florida?
So Sanders praised Fidel Castro's literacy program, universal education system, and free health care. And this did not go well with South Floridians here. South Florida has a lot of Latinos from Cuba, Venezuela, Honduras, and other Central American countries where authoritarianism is a big deal. So when Sanders said those comments, South Florida exploded. Many Florida lawmakers from both sides had tons to say.
Yeah, so I sense a bit of a generation gap. Are young Latinos in Florida who are Cuban American or other young people with ties to Central and South America like Venezuela, are they aware of that history and do they care?
Yeah, but it varies. I've been talking to many young Latinos in South Florida who will be voting for the first time this year. Here's Janelis Ayuso. Her parents are Cuban and Puerto Rican. She says she understands both sides of the socialist argument.
Like, he's not wrong. I'm half Cuban myself, and my family by no means are supporters of Castro's regime or anything like that. But people are literally traveling to Cuba in order to learn and to get their degrees for free.
So like Janelis, I've heard from other young Latinos in South Florida who say they will vote for Sanders because he talks about the issues and how those issues are going to impact their lives now, like school debt, affordable health care. And that's what they care about, not so much the labels.
Mm. What about their parents or an older generation of Cuban or Venezuelan Americans? Is the older generation mostly conservative in their views? And how do they feel about Sanders?
Yeah, that's typically the trend. But then you have young Latinos like Anthony Goyanes. He's 18 and a first-time voter. Some of his family members don't have water or enough money to get food in Cuba.
So I think it is unacceptable for Bernie Sanders to be making such comments about Cuba. That regime caused immense pain to not just my family, but thousands more.
So Florida is big for these two presidential hopefuls, and Bernie Sanders is already struggling in Florida, so he's going to need all the votes he can get. Are young Latino voters going to demonstrate the same level of non-participation that we've seen in other primaries? And is COVID-19, social distancing regimes, is that going to lower the turnout even more?
I've talked to a couple of like civic engagement organizations who are like getting out the vote and encouraging young black and brown voters to go vote. The big question right now is it safe to go vote? And state officials have been telling us that yes, you know, voting sites will have Clorox wipes, hand sanitizers, soaps and restrooms. They're going to be wiping down every ballot box after someone votes. But I think the biggest problem right now is, you know, poll workers are concerned and they don't want to show up. Voters don't want to show up themselves because they don't want to put their family or themselves at risk. As of right now, there's about 2 million people who have voted early in Florida, and voting by mail is encouraged. I'm just going to be curious to see how this is going to play out.
Yeah, it is a challenging election process this time for sure. Alejandra, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Marco.
That was Alejandra Martinez, producer at WLRN in Miami. She's also part of our Every 30 Seconds project, tracking the young Latino vote in the United States. They were first discovered in the Judean desert in the mid-1940s. The Dead Sea Scrolls are ancient religious manuscripts dating as far back as the 3rd century BC. The Museum of the Bible in Washington was lucky enough to have a collection of these biblical artifacts, actual fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls, or at least that's what the museum thought it had. For months, researchers have been working to determine if those fragments are real or just really good forgeries. Now, their verdict is in. Colette Lall is the director of Art Fraud Insights, which led this project. Colette, these Dead Sea Scroll fragments, real or fake?
Well, unfortunately, we have concluded that every one of them is, in fact, inauthentic. So none of them are real.
When did the museum first have an inkling that the scrolls might be fake?
Since 2002, more than 70 Dead Sea Scroll fragments appeared on the antiquities market. And many Dead Sea Scroll experts endorsed them as authentic. And between 2009 and 2014, the president of Hobby Lobby, Steve Green, and a collector who's also a collector of biblical manuscripts and artifacts, purchased them and planned to display them in his soon-to-be-built Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. He also published them, and several scholars were involved in this publication, and they all believed them to be authentic. However, there were some anomalies that started to raise some red flags, and so questions started to be asked right before the publication came out in 2016. After they were published, more red flags were raised, and people started to question their authenticity altogether.
So what were these Dead Sea Scrolls made of? Like, how did the forgers make a compelling piece that fooled collectors?
Well, it was compelling because they used material that was ancient or archaeological in nature. So after 2,000 years, parchment and leather look very similar, and they're both made from animal skin. I guess the best way to describe the technique of the forger is that, you know, physically they were more wrong than chemically. They used ancient materials, but then they used modern inks and applied scripture to a substrate that was in fact not correct. Instead of using parchment, they used leather. We were able to look at the way that the ink was actually applied to the substrate, and we saw evidence of, for example, the ink going over cracks or water falling off at edge. Things that you wouldn't find on a piece of clean parchment that would have been used by a scribe 2,000 years ago, but things that were indicative that already fragmented material was being repurposed.
So a flat piece of leather, did somebody like back in the day kind of take the bottom of an old shoe or something?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of our theories is that some of the holes in the fragments look man-made instead of the holes that would be made by insects boring through old material. And so they look like they might have been tied to either sewing holes or even lacing holes from Roman shoes, perhaps early Roman period. So the timing isn't right. The structure is not right. There's a lot of things that led us to believe that the material just wasn't quite accurate.
So, Colette, as someone immersed in art authenticity, do you go in a museum and get torn between appreciating the art and wondering if it's real?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it does get in the way sometimes of my appreciation. I always have a little thing in the back of my mind saying, I wonder if that's right, or I wonder if that's authentic. In this case, you know, this is the first project I've been involved with involving ancient texts, and it's been a fascinating project, but I'm, you know, by nature, a tenacious truth seeker, and I feel that you know, getting to the truth is the most important thing, and sometimes that truth is unfortunate. And for the museum's case, they absolutely wanted to get to the truth. And we designed a project with an approach that was meant to be objective and independent and as transparent as possible. And we achieved that together, and we came up with some incredible conclusions. And, you know, I think this is just the first domino that's about to fall. There's a lot of other question fragments and other collections, whether it be institutional collections, private collections, or even university collections. So I think people are going to start looking more seriously at their collections, and this is just the beginning.
Colette Lall, the director of Art Fraud Insights, thank you. Stay tenacious.
Thank you.
It's a sad St. Patrick's Day across Ireland, across the world, really, now that pubs in so many countries are closed for health safety. Guinness flowing at home from a can just ain't the same thing. And do you have someone who can play a few reels in your kitchen? Probably not. So we offer you this. Up in Canada, on the island of Cape Breton, fiddler Ashley McIsaac won't be in a pub today. He's practicing social distancing. What you just heard was from a little gig he played a couple of years ago in Mabou, Nova Scotia, in the kitchen of the musical Beaton family. That kind of intimate crowd just is not doable right now. McIsaac told the CBC what he's planning, not for today, but for April 1st, and no, it's not a joke, an online-only quarantine ceilidh, or dance.
It's pretty simple. A lot of people are going to get bored of watching reruns and and continuing to see how many times they can watch Stranger Things on Netflix over the next couple of months. I figured as artists that go out and perform across the country, go to communities all the time, have that live feeling with people that is shared both from the audience and the stage, that something like that would work very well right now on the internet. We're musicians. We're used to traveling. We can't do it. People can't come out to see our shows. So we're going to bring it to your living room.
Ashley McIsaac wants to treat this like a real concert. He's still got to make a living after all. You pay a few bucks, Canadian, and that's your ticket to the online Quarantine Kaylee. It'll be like any other show, except more relaxed.
You don't have to get dressed up. You can sit home in your underwear and watch the Kaylee.
A selling point, for sure. McIsaac thinks his opening number for the Quarantine Kaylee will be the theme to Gilligan's Island. He calls it the original quarantine song. For today, though, St. Patrick's Day, let's go back to Nova Scotia and Ashley McIsaac's fiddle. Don't want to wait till April 1st? You can catch this entire performance by Ashley McIsaac and the Beatons of Mabu at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be right back here with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.